Chapter 19. Places, and the woman, having denounced him, was immediately assured by her confessor that any debt incurred to a seducer was null and void, and that she was entitled to 100 scudi of damages for having been led into sin. 2.10. At the Duke's express wish, Odo was to lodge in the palace, and when he entered the courtyard he found Canto Presto waiting to lead him to his apartment. The rooms assigned to him lay at the end of one of the wings overlooking the gardens, and as he mounted the great stairway and walked down the corridors with their frescoed walls and busts of Roman emperors, he recalled the far-off night when he had passed through the same scenes as a frightened, awestruck child, where he had then beheld a supernatural fabric, peopled with divinities of bronze and marble, and glowing with light and color. He now saw a many-corridored palace, stately indeed, and full of a faded splendor, but dull and antiquated in comparison with the newfangled elegance of the Sardinian court. Yet at every turn some object thrilled the fibers of old association or pride of race. Here he traversed a gallery hung with the portraits of his line, there caught a glimpse of the pages Anticum through which he and his mother had been led when they waited on the Duke, and from the windows of his closet he overlooked the alleys and terraces where he had wandered with the hunchback. One of the Duke's pages came to say that His Highness would receive the Cavalier when the court rose from dinner, and finding himself with 2 hours on his hands, Odo determined to await his kinsman's summons in the garden. Thither he presently repaired, and was soon, with a mournful pleasure, retracing the paths he had first explored in such an ecstasy of wonder. The pleached walks and parterres were in all the freshness of June. Roses and jasmine mingled on the terrace walls, citron trees ingeniously grafted with red, and white carnations stood in fenza jars before the lemon house, and marble nymphs and fauns peeped from thickets of flowering camellias. A noise of childish voices presently attracted Odo, and following a tunnel of clipped limes he came out on a theater cut in the turf, and set about with statues of Apollo and the Muses. A handful of boys in military dress were performing a series of evolutions in the center of this space, and facing them stood a child of about 10 years, in a colonel's uniform covered with orders, his hair curled and powdered, a pasteboard sword in his hand, and his frail body supported on one side by a turbaned dwarf, and on the other by an ecclesiastic who was evidently his governor. The child, as Odo approached, was calling out his orders to his regiment in a weak, shrill voice, moving now here, now there on his booted, tottering legs, as his two supporters guided him, and painfully trying to flourish the paper weapon that was too heavy for his nerveless wrist. Behind this strange group stood another figure, that of a tall, heavy man, richly dressed, with a curious oriental-looking order on his breast, and a veiled somnolent eye which he kept fixed on the little prince. Odo had been about to advance and do homage to his cousin, but a sign from the man in the background arrested him. The maneuvers were soon over, the heir was lifted into a little gilded chariot drawn by white goats, his regiment formed in line and saluted him, and he disappeared down one of the alleys with his attendants. This ceremony over, the tall man advanced to Odo with a bow, and asked pardon for the liberty he had taken. "You are doubtless," said he, "His Highness's cousin, the Cavalier Valseca, and my excuse for intruding between yourself and the prince is that I am the Duke's physician, Count Heiligenstern, and that the heir is at present undergoing a course of treatment under my care. His health, as you probably know, has long been a cause of anxiety to his illustrious parents, and when I was summoned to Pianura the College of Physicians had given up all hope of saving him. Since my coming, however, I flatter myself that a marked change is perceptible. My method is that of invigorating the blood by exciting the passions most likely to produce a generous vital ardor. Thus, by organizing these juvenile maneuvers, I arouse the prince's martial zeal. By encouraging him to study the history of his ancestors, I evoke his political ambition. by causing him to be led about the gardens on a pony, accompanied by a miniature pack of Maltese dogs in pursuit of a tame doe. I stimulate the passion of the chase, but it is essential to my system that one emotion should not violently counteract another, and I am therefore obliged to protect my noble patient from the sudden intrusion of new impressions. This explanation, delivered in a sententious tone, and with a strong German accent, seemed to Odo no more than a learned travesty of the familiar and pathetic expedient of distracting a sick child by the pretense of manly diversions. He was struck, however, by the physician's aspect, and would have engaged him in talk had not one of the Duke's gentlemen appeared with the announcement that His Highness would be pleased to receive the Cavalier Valsecca. Like most dwellings of its kind in Italy, the palace of Pianura resembled one of those shells which reveal by their outer convolutions the gradual development of the creature housed within. For two or three generations after Braxiafort, the terrible founder of the line, had made himself master of the Republic, his descendants had clung to the old brick fortress Araca which the great Condottiere had held successfully against the burghers' arquebuses and the battering rams of rival adventurers, and which still glassed its battlements in the slow waters of the Piana beside the city wall. It was Ascanio, the first duke, the correspondent of Politian and Castiglian, who, finding the ancestral heir too cramped for the court of a humanist prince, had summoned Luciano Dallorana to build a palace better fitted to his state. Duke Ascanio, in bronze by Verrocchio, still looked up with pride from the palace square at the brick and terracotta facade with its fruit-wreathed arches crowned by imperial profiles. But a later prince found the small rooms and intricate passages of Lorana's structure inadequate to the pomp of an ally of Leo X, and Vignola added the state apartments, the sculpture gallery and the libraries. The palace now passed for one of the wonders of Italy. The Duke's guest, the witty and learned Aretino, celebrated it in verse, his friend Cardinal Bembo in prose. Correggio painted the walls of one room, Giulio Romano the ceiling of another. It seemed that magnificence could go no farther, till the 17th century brought to the throne a duke who asked himself how a self-respecting prince could live without a theater, a writing school and an additional wing, to lodge the ever-growing train of court officials who had by this time replaced the feudal men-at-arms. He answered the question by laying an extra tax on his people and inviting to Pianura the great Roman architect Carlo Borromini, who regretfully admitted that his illustrious patron was on the whole less royally housed than their highnesses of Mantua and Parma. Within 5 years of Valarisa, the theater and the gardens flung defiance at these aspiring potentates, and again Pianura took precedence of her rivals. The present Duke's father had expressed the most recent tendency of the race by the erection of a chapel in the florid Jesuit style, and the group of buildings thus chronicled in rich durable lines the varying passions and ambitions of 300 years of power. As Odo followed his guide toward the Duke's apartments, he remarked a change in the aspect of the palace. Where formerly the corridors had been thronged with pages, lackeys and gaily dressed cavaliers and ladies, only a few ecclesiastics now glided by. Here a Monsignor in ermine and lace rochet, attended by his chaplain and secretaries, there a cowled Dominican or a sober-looking secular priest. The Duke was lodged in the oldest portion of the palace, and Odo, who had never visited these apartments, looked with interest at the projecting sculptured chimney and vaulted ceiling of the page's antechamber, which had formerly been the guardroom and was still hung with panoplies. Thence he was led into a gallery lined with scriptural tapestries and furnished in the heavy style of the 17th century. Here he waited a few moments, hearing the sound of conversation in the room beyond. Then the door of this apartment opened, and a handsome Dominican passed out, followed by a page who invited Odo to step into the Duke's cabinet. This was a very small room, completely paneled in delicate wood carving touched with gold. over this paneling, regardless of the beauty of its design, had been hung a mass of reliquaries and small devotional bas-reliefs and paintings, making the room appear more like the chapel of a wonder-working saint than a prince's closet. Here again Odo found himself alone, but the page presently returned to say that his highness was not well, and begged the cavalier to wait on him in his bedchamber. The most conspicuous object in this room was a great bedstead raised on a dais. The plumed posts and sumptuous hangings of the bed gave it an altar-like air, and the duke himself, who lay between the curtains, his wig replaced by a nightcap, a scapular about his neck, and his shriveled body wrapped in a brocaded dressing gown, looked more like a relic than a man. His heavy underlip trembled slightly as he offered his hand to Odo's salute. "You find me, cousin," said he after a brief greeting, much troubled by a question that has of late incessantly disturbed my rest, "can the soul, after full intuition of God, be polluted by the sins of the body?" He clutched Odo's hand in his burning grasp. "Is it possible that there are human beings so heedless of their doom that they can go about their earthly pleasures with this awful problem unsolved? Oh, why has not some pope decided it? Why has God left this hideous uncertainty hanging over us? You know the doctrine of Plotinus: he who has access to God leaves the virtues behind him as the images of the gods are left in the outer temple." Many of the fathers believed that the Neoplatonists were permitted to foreshadow in their teachings the revelation of Christ. But on these occult points much doubt remains, and though certain of the great theologians have inclined to this interpretation, there are others who hold that it leans to the heresy of Quietism. Odo, who had inferred in the duke's opening words an allusion to the little prince's ill health, or to some political anxiety, was at a loss how to reply to this strange appeal, but after a moment he said, "I have heard that your highness's director is a man of great learning and discrimination. Can he not help your highness to some decision on this point?" The duke glanced at him suspiciously. "If Father Ignazio," said he, "is in fact well versed in theology, but there are certain doctrines inaccessible to all but a few who have received the direct illumination of heaven, and on this point I cannot feel that his judgment is final." He wiped the dampness from his sallow forehead and pressed the scapular to his lips. "May you never know," he cried, "the agony of a father whose child is dying, of a sovereign who longs to labor for the welfare of his people, but who is racked by the thought that in giving his mind to temporal duties and domestic affections, while such spiritual difficulties are still unsolved, he may be preparing for himself an eternity of torture such as that," and he pointed to an old and blackened picture of the Last Judgment that hung on the opposite wall. Odo tried to frame a soothing rejoinder, but the duke passionately interrupted him. "Alas, cousin, no rest is possible for one who has attained the rapture of the beatific vision, yet who trembles lest the mere mechanical indulgence of the senses may still subject him to the common penalty of sin. As a man who has devoted himself to the study of theology is privileged to argue on questions forbidden to the vulgar, so surely fasting, maceration, and ecstasy must liberate the body from the bondage of prescribed morality. Shall no distinction be recognized between my conduct and that of the common sot or debauchee whose soul lies in blind subjection to his lower instincts? I, who have labored early and late to remove temptation from my people, who have punished offenses against conduct as unsparingly as spiritual error, I, who have not scrupled to destroy every picture in my galleries that contained a nude figure or a wanton attitude, I, who have been blessed from childhood by tokens of divine favor and miraculous intervention, can I doubt that I have earned the privileges of that higher state in which the soul is no longer responsible for the failings of the body? And yet what if I were mistaken?" he moaned. "What if my advisors have deceived me? Si autem sic impius sum, quare frustra laboravi?" And he sank back on his pillows limp as an empty glove. alarmed at his disorder, Odo stood irresolute whether to call for help. But as he hesitated, the Duke feebly drew from his bosom a gold key attached to a slender Venetian chain. "This," said he, "unlocks the small tortoise-shell cabinet yonder. In it you will find a phial of clear liquor, a few drops of which will restore me. 'Tis an essence distilled by the Benedictine nuns of the Perpetual Adoration, and peculiarly effective in excesses of spiritual disturbance." Odo complied, and having poured the liquor into a glass, held it to his cousin's lips. In a moment the Duke's eye revived, and he began to speak in a weak but composed voice, with an air of dignity in singular contrast to his previous self-abandonment. I am," said he, "unhappily subject to such seizures after any prolonged exertion, and the conversation I have just had with my director has left me in no fit state to receive you. The cares of government sit heavy on one who has scarce health enough for the duties of a private station, and were it not for my son I should long since have withdrawn to the shelter of the monastic life." He paused and looked at Odo with a melancholy kindness. "In you," said he, "the native weakness of our complexion appears to have been tempered by the blood of your mother's house, and your countenance gives every promise of health and vivacity." He broke off with a sigh, and continued in a more authoritative tone. "You have learned from Count Tresker my motive in summoning you to Pianura. My son's health causes me the liveliest concern, my own is subject to such seizures as you have just witnessed. I cannot think that, in this age of infidelity and disorder, God can design to deprive a Christian state of a line of sovereigns uniformly zealous in the defense of truth. But the purposes of heaven are inscrutable, as the recent suppression of the Society of Jesus has most strangely proved. And should our dynasty be extinguished, I am consoled by the thought that the rule will pass to one of our house. Of this I shall have more to say to you in future. Meanwhile, your first business is to acquaint yourself with your new surroundings. The Duchess holds a circle this evening, where you will meet the court, but I must advise you that the persons Her Highness favors with her intimacy are not those best qualified to guide and instruct a young man in your position. These you will meet at the house of the Countess Belverde, one of the Duchess's ladies, a woman of sound judgment and scrupulous piety, who gathers about her all our most learned and saintly ecclesiastics. Count Tresker will instruct you in all that becomes your position at court, and my director, Father Ignazio, will aid you in the selection of a confessor. As to the bishop, a most worthy and conversable prelate, to whom I would have you show all due regard, his zeal in spiritual matters is not as great as I could wish, and in private talk he indulges in a laxity of opinion against which I cannot too emphatically warn you. Happily, however, Pianura offers other opportunities of edification. Father Ignazio is a man of wide learning and inflexible doctrine, and in several of our monasteries, notably that of the Barnabites, you will find examples of sanctity and wisdom such as a young man may well devoutly consider. Our convents also are distinguished for the severity of their rule, and the spiritual privileges accorded them. The Carmelites have every reason to hope for the beatification of their aged prioress, and among the nuns of the Perpetual Adoration is one who has recently received the ineffable grace of the Vulnus Divinum. In the conversation of these saintly nuns, and of the holy abbot of the Barnabites, you will find the surest safeguard against those errors and temptations that beset your age. He leaned back with a gesture of dismissal, but added, reddening slightly, as Odo prepared to withdraw, "You will oblige me, cousin, when you meet my physician, Count Heiligenstern, by not touching on the matter of the restorative you have seen me take." Odo left his cousin's presence with a feeling of deep discouragement. To a spirit aware of the new influences abroad, and fresh from contact with evils rooted in the very foundations of the existing system, there was a peculiar irony in being advised to seek guidance and instruction in the society of ecstatic nuns and cloistered theologians. The Duke, with his sickly soul agrope in a maze of Neoplatonism and probabilism, while his people groaned under unjust taxes, while knowledge and intellectual liberty languished in a kind of moral pest house, seemed to Odo like a ruler who, in time of famine, should keep the royal granaries locked, and spend his days praying for the succor that his own hand might have dispensed. In the tapestry room, one of his highness's gentlemen waited to reconduct Odo. Their way lay through the portrait gallery, of which he had previously caught a glimpse, and here he begged his guide to leave him. He felt a sudden desire to meet his unknown ancestors face to face, and to trace the tendencies which, from the grim Braxiaford and the stately skeptical humanist of Leo's age, had mysteriously forced the race into its ever-narrowing mold. The dusky canvases, hung high in tarnished escutcheoned frames, presented a continuous chronicle of the line, from Braxiaford himself, with his predatory profile outlined by some early Tuscan hand against the turrets of his impregnable fortress. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.